You're listening to The Legal Eagle with Marsha Chambers on WNHHLP 103.5 FM.
Welcome to The Legal Eagle, where we explore many of the legal issues Connecticut residents face in one form or another every day. We look into the criminal and civil justice system, both at the state and federal level. We discuss issues facing the bar, the judiciary, the courts, and the legislature.
No, keep going, Marsha.
Today we welcome State Representative Sean Scanlon, who represents the 98th District on the shoreline, specifically Guilford and two parts of Brantford, Stony Creek and Pine Orchard. And we do so after the 2017 legislative session has ended, and it has ended without a budget. Sean is a rising star in the Democratic Party, and he is joining us by phone from his office. So, Sean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Marsha. Good morning.
Good morning. How is it up there in Hartford today? Hot and sunny?
Hot and sunny, and a lot better than yesterday. We had some pretty ominous rainstorms going through the state, and my commute back to Guilford was a little wet.
Yes, mine too. I was up and about, and I have had the same experience. So, the session ended without a budget. Could you tell us the status of where the budget talks are right now in June? I think you've got two more weeks until roughly July, and that's a demarcation point of some sort.
Yeah, so I don't really know too much about what's happening. You know, I'm not one of the leaders in the legislature, meaning the majority leader, the speaker, the Senate president, who's actually in the room talking to the other side and the governor. But I do know that they are working very hard to try to find a compromise budget before June 30th. But June 30th really is sort of an arbitrary deadline in the sense that, you know, the government in Connecticut doesn't shut down like it does in Washington. There's different ways that, you know, the legislature or the governor can fund the state government services and programs until we get a deal. But I know that our leadership, at least in the House, is hopeful that we can try to get something done before the 30th. And if not before the 30th, I think shortly thereafter.
Right. And so there has been an exchange of the budgets, right? Of the Democratic budget, the Republican budget, and the governor's budget? I mean,
there's been a lot of budgets that have been thrown around last few months, and they are meeting regularly. I know they met yesterday. I think they're meeting again today. And like I said, I think they're definitely trying here pretty hard to get this done.
It's been pretty difficult, as you know, for towns to be able to deal with their budgets. Brantford had great difficulty. I don't know how Guilford did it. Maybe you could explain. But each town seems to have had to find their way once they were told that they might be responsible or would be responsible for payment of teacher pensions, which in the past they hadn't been.
Yeah, you know, the governor put out a proposal as he or she who holds that office has the right to do every February of the odd-numbered year. And that sort of kicks off a conversation that lasts typically from February to June when our session ends in what we refer to as the long session, which is in the odd-numbered years. And his budget definitely did draw a lot of attention and a fair amount of criticism, especially in communities like Guilford and Brantford, because of the changes he suggested with regard to the teacher pension. And you sort of alluded to that. Basically, the state essentially serves as a bank almost for the teacher pension system in Connecticut. You know, towns like Guilford and Brantford and all municipalities decide some basic services that they're offering or you know, benefits that they're offering and how much they're going to pay teachers and how many they're going to hire. And then the teacher pays into the state system. The governor had argued that since the towns are really the ones deciding how many teachers there's going to be and, you know, how they're going to be compensated, that they should have some stake in the game. But he proposed that automatically and right away, towns do one third of that proportion. And to a lot of municipalities, that's a ton of money that they were not expecting or budgeting for. And a lot of them argued fairly, in my opinion, that that would just be, you know, basically passed along to the property tax owners in the state, this year, which, you know, is something we hear a lot about in Connecticut, which is the high property taxes are killers. So I think that proposal specifically is probably dead in the legislature right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the future years, there was a conversation between municipalities and the state about potentially finding some sort of cost sharing when it comes to teacher pensions.
Right, right. Or at least finding a way to handle the situation so that towns are not confronted with this, you know, 2 months before they have to declare their budget. How do they do it in Guilford? How do they cope with the teacher pension thing?
Well, you know, in our budgeting process, unlike in Brantford, we have sort of an old Connecticut institution, which is that we pass our budget by referendum. Unlike in Brantford, where they do it on the Board of Finance, the RTM, we actually give every voter in Guilford a chance to
vote.
Have a say in the actual budget. Our leadership in Guilford attributed for about a 35% cut from where we were last year. Jamie Cosgrove, first selectman in Brantford, attributed for a full cut. Mm-hmm. And you know, I, along with my colleagues in the Brantford and Guilford delegations, have been in constant communication with our municipal leaders and, frankly, the voters who are looking at what's going on and reading these articles, wondering whether they're going to get a bigger property tax hit. But I think both Joe Mazza and Jamie Cosgrove did the right thing by putting in some hit. Mm-hmm. There are some towns in Connecticut that didn't put any hit in and are going to, I think, have to face some pretty big problems. But these guys have planned for the worst to varying degrees. And I hope we're going to be able to, in both cases, come back to them and say that it wasn't as bad as we anticipated, and then the mill rates will be lower than they're being anticipated to be right now.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at the last session. We should also tell our listeners that Representative Scanlon is the co-chairman of the Insurance and Real Estate Committee. And last, I guess it must have been in May, Sean, that you led the House in passing legislation that would, for the first time, regulate rideshare companies, you know, the Uber thing.
Yep.
Could you, and it's a new law, right? And what does it do?
Well, your listeners don't see me, but I'm one of the younger members of the General Assembly.
This is true. How old are you? How old are you now, Sean? I meant to ask you.
I'm 30 years old.
So, wow.
You know, my generation, and many of your listeners, especially in cities like New Haven and even in the suburbs, we love to use what are known as rideshare companies, but they're more commonly known as Uber, Lyft, and it's really a great way of getting from point A to point B, especially, you know, if you're out with friends or you're looking to go meet up with somebody, you know, you can just call up an Uber, and it's a pretty easy way to get around. The problem is that Connecticut was one of the few states that didn't have any regulations on the books to protect consumers from those companies. So we passed a bill that was a three-year long project for me, and it passed the House in 2015, but didn't ever come up for a vote in the Senate. We tried again this year, and I'm very happy to say it's been passed by the House and Senate. It's awaiting the signature of the governor. And Marcia, you know, the three biggest components of it were that we require background checks for drivers to make sure that, you know, folks who are getting into these Ubers are not getting into the car with somebody who's had, you know, multiple convictions for, you know, vehicle-related felonies, or somebody who had been convicted of, you know, DUI several times. We made sure that their vehicles are being inspected so that there's some assurance that, you know, when you get into a plane, a train, or a bus in your daily life, you have some reasonable expectation that those have been vetted by somebody. Uber was not the case, so we wanted to apply the same standard of safety. And the last big thing that it did was it created some insurance standards so that, God forbid, if you're in an Uber and that driver gets into a really bad accident, you can be assured that you're going to be able to get some protection for that and that you'll be compensated for that if it's determined to be the fault of the driver. And those three things are pretty commonly accepted all across the country. We just were a little slow at getting them done here in Connecticut, but I'm proud to say that it's awaiting the governor's signature, and I have every reason to believe he's going to sign the bill this year.
That's great. While discussing this, Sean, you mentioned something that maybe I could discuss a little bit with you, and that is it took three times to pass this Uber law, so to speak. And that often happens with bills, where a bill will pass the House and then it dies in the Senate, and it dies often because time runs out. This seems to be a recurring problem in the legislature, that a good bill, a necessary bill, everybody's on board more or less, but it can't get through in one House or the other. Typically, the Senate, it fails. So, and it's often because of the timing. It's sort of the end of the session, and you've got 24 hours to do it. Is there any way that the legislature can start to talk about fixing their own problems?
You know, I think it's something that I know you and I have definitely discussed in the past, and I talk to people a lot about it. You know, we are a citizen legislature. It's a part-time legislature. A lot of people don't really realize that, but you know, each of us are only being paid about $28,000 a year to do this job, and the legislature is only really meeting for 6 months out of the year. Now, of course, all of us are getting called 12 months of the year about constituent issues, or you know, somebody who's having a problem with the DMV or with their health insurance, but we're only physically in session passing laws 6 months of the year. And so we have this sort of quirky system where if the bill doesn't pass by a certain time, which is usually it's midnight on either the first Monday in June or the first Monday in May, depending on what year it is, everything dies. I think, you know, there are some folks who have talked about in the past of, you know, whether we should maybe have a more professional legislature because, you know, what worked back, you know, 150 years ago in Connecticut is a little different now. Some folks obviously think the less time we're up there, the better because of their ideology. But I think it's something that we should maybe explore. And if we ever did decide to professionalize our legislature, as New York and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and all the other states around us do, I would be very much in favor of reducing the number of legislators. So, you know, we're having less folks up there and maybe paying them a little more, because I do sometimes worry that the salary very much self-selects who can participate.
Right.
And that's why I'm one of the younger members up there. There's only 25 members of the legislature who are under the age of 40, and there's 181 legislators. So we are very much in the minority, and the major reason for that is because people that are my age who are having kids and buying houses and trying to get their families started can't often afford to live on $28,000 a year.
Right, right. Okay, so that's one way. I remember that State Senator Ted Kennedy, your colleague, had suggested that if a bill passes in one House, it should just be, you know, come back the next year. You don't have to go through the whole process of redefining it and voting on it again. Is that also an option, perhaps, to think about?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an option, and it's something that I would probably be in favor of. I just don't know how much resistance that would be. That's not certainly ever a reason not to try something, but I do think that there's, you know, folks are pretty set in their ways about this system, and they like it because they know that if they can run out the clock and kill a bill by a certain time, they are safe for, you know, 6 months or 7 months until the next session. And so you got to remember that there's a ton of lobbyists that get paid a lot of money to come up in Hartford and either pass or kill bills every day on behalf of various interests. And that system works quite well for them. And, you know, I think we should certainly have that conversation, but it will likely meet some resistance.
Okay. I'm glad you described the other element to it. So let's talk a little bit about the public financing law, which I know you and the other legislators, Senator Kennedy and the state rep Lonnie Reed, have used in the past. I gather it ran into some trouble. Could you give us an update on the public financing law, what it is, what it does, and whether it has any future?
Yeah, well, I think it definitely has a future. And for your listeners who aren't necessarily familiar with that, in the aftermath of Governor Boland's big scandal, which revolved around money and politics, Jody Rell, to her credit, and the Democratic legislature passed what really is a landmark program, called the Citizens Election Program, in which candidates for either state rep or state senate, and frankly, governor, raise a little bit of money from within their district and some folks who live in their communities to show that they have some semblance of support. And then the state then gives them a money that they can use to run their campaign. And what that does, Marcia, it really just levels the playing field and takes money outside of politics. So when I ran for office the first time in 2014, I raised the necessary money I had to raise in 3 days. And then I spent from April until November knocking on doors and talking to voters about issues rather than sitting in an office building all day and calling strangers for money, which is what you unfortunately have to do to run for Congress or, you know, the United States Senate or, frankly, the state legislature in a lot of other places. And with this law, it takes money out, mostly out of the equation. We can focus on the issues and the campaign at hand. This year, we did make some changes to it, particularly with regard to the amount of money that candidates get, for example, if they're unopposed. Last time around in 2016, I was unopposed, but I still went out there and knocked on a lot of doors because I didn't want to take anything for granted. And most importantly, I wanted to be able to interact with my constituents. So I did spend a little bit of money. I didn't buy, you know, the stupid tchotchke stuff like balloons and jar openers and stuff like that. I used it to buy a survey that I would then give out to my constituents. So there was some talk about getting rid of all money for those who are unopposed or who are facing, you know, only minor party opposition. But I think it's important for you to be able to sort of talk to your constituents in the manner that I did last time around. And so we did pass sort of a compromise that basically says that your grant is reduced if you have no opponent and that you have to apply for the money by a certain period of time. So you can't wait until November 1st when the election is November 8th and then spend $20,000 in 7 days. You have to do it over an extended period of time.
I see. So that's the change. And you think it's safe? You think the, cause you, has there been a vote on it?
Well, there are always people who argue that we should get rid of it. It costs about $13 million every 2 years to run it. And that sounds like a lot of money to you and me because we don't come from a lot of money. But when you think about the fact that the state budget every 2 years is $20 billion, it's not that much money in the grand scheme of things, and it keeps our elections clean. But there are a lot of folks who want to get rid of it on both sides of the aisle because, you know, I hate to say this, but incumbents can raise a lot of money. And, you know, there was some folks that sort of came to me, and I was very vocal in saying that I wanted to keep this law in 2015 when it was threatened to be cut. And some folks came to me in Hartford and said, you know, you're pretty stupid to do that because as an incumbent, you could probably raise twice as much or three times as much as your opponent. So you should oppose this. And I think that that's probably true, but I don't think that's good for democracy. And I think it's good to be on a level playing field. That way, it's not about who raises more money or who's spending more money. It's just about the ideas and the candidates. And frankly, I think that's the best thing for our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Speaking of your constituents, you held a meeting with your constituents about the budget, you know, a couple of months ago, I think, out in Guilford, right?
Yep.
And they all.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I held what I called the Citizens Budget Workshop.
Yeah, that was new,
and I'm always looking.
That was new, wasn't it, Sean? And something that kind of original?
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever done it. And to be honest with you, I was a little nervous about what to expect. I didn't really know how it'd be received. But I am sort of constantly looking for ways to interact with the folks that I represent and do it in sort of non-traditional ways. And I could have, office hours and a town hall meeting. And in fact, I'm doing one of those office hours tonight in Guilford at 6:30 at the community center. But I wanted to do something sort of outside the box. And so I sort of sat down with my staff in Hartford and said, hey, guys, I want to give you a little bit of a challenge. I want to come up with a game, so to speak, for lack of a better word, that we take the best ideas that the Republicans have put forward on the budget and the best ideas the Democrats have put forward and come up with flashcards. And we're going to pair people together in groups and we're going to give them the most common options from the left and the right and say, hey, guys, there's a $2 billion deficit. How are you going to balance it? And let them work on it. And so we had about 75 people show up. I gave them 40 options. We had 10 groups, and 9 of the 10 came to a balanced budget. And I made sure that each individual group, which probably had 8 or 10 people in them, had an even number of Democrats and Republicans. It got a lot of attention. I think the folks who were there really liked it. And whenever anybody asked me sort of what I took out of it, I tell them very simply that what I took out of it was if these people can spend 2 hours on a Tuesday night sitting with their neighbors that they don't necessarily always agree with on politics and figure this thing out, then we should be able to do the same thing up in Hartford.
That's interesting. And what were the general conclusions that they drew in the different areas that interested you?
It's very interesting. I think that, all of the groups recognize that, we probably can't just cut our way out of a budget deficit this big and that sort of new revenue had to be on the table. And the most popular one, to be honest with you, was a tax on sugary beverages, which some other states and municipalities have done, increasing the taxes on, things like alcohol and cigarettes. We're seen as sort of no-brainers to a lot of these folks.
Uh-huh.
And there were some programs that they wanted to see cut. But by and large, I think what most people took out of it was that you can't just cut everything and you can't just raise taxes to balance this. It's got to be a more balanced approach. And that's when, you really see people sort of, they walk in the door with a set ideology. And after the end of it, you see it's a little bit harder. I have folks that come to my meetings all the time and tell me, Marcia, that we should just cut spending. We should cut $5 billion of spending. And then when you hand somebody the flashcards on the appropriation and say, okay, here's the 20 appropriations programs for children with disabilities, aid to our seniors, aid to our veterans, and you ask them, okay, well, which program do you want to cut? It becomes a little harder.
Right. When they're in the mix.
That's the goal
of
what I want.
Right. Fascinating. When you put them in the mix and they have to make proposed changes, everything changes, right?
Right. Correct.
I wondered if we could just chat a little bit about your interest in the opioid problem in Connecticut,
yeah,
because you basically started when you just arrived, if I recall, right? You began to discuss the problem of opioid use in the state. Tell us a little bit about that and also what's happened since, because the governor has signed a number of bills into law.
Yeah, so, a sad fact of reality here in Connecticut is that this year in 2017, more people in our state are going to die from opioid overdoses than they will from car accidents and gun violence combined. It's the primary cause of death for every American under the age of 50 today in America. And when you really think about those two statistics, it really blows your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a suburban problem. This is not an urban problem. This is a problem that's happening in every single town in Connecticut. We had about 923 people die of this last year.
Wow.
In Connecticut. We're on course to go be about where that is. And this really, you know, we could probably spend the entire show talking about this issue, and I'm obviously very passionate about it, but this basically boils down to the fact that between, you know, 1990s and about, you know, the last five or so years, large pharmaceutical companies made billions of dollars creating all these new opioids, which are known as Oxycontin, Vicodin, and pain became sort of the fifth vital sign for medicine. And because of that, we had a 15, 20-year concentrated period where there was enough prescriptions out there in our society for every human being to have at least one full bottle of pills in America. And this overprescribing led to this dramatic surplus of these dangerous and powerful drugs that when, for example, you get your wisdom teeth out and you're 17 years old, your doctor would send you home with 45 Oxycontin pills. And you may only take three or four before you feel better, but that surplus winds up in your medicine cabinet. And over time, people began taking them for non-medical reasons. And to make a long story short, four in five new people who start using heroin start with prescription drugs. And 50% of those folks are getting them from a loved one or a friend, medicine cabinet. And so since I got to the legislature in 2015, I've been fortunate to have worked with some great legislative colleagues and the governor and, frankly, people on both sides of the aisle to pass three different pieces of legislation. The most significant one, I believe, in terms of addressing the root problem is in 2016, we passed a bill that would limit all first-time prescriptions for opioids for acute pain to 7 days' worth supply. So what that means, Marcia, is that if you have terminal cancer or if you had a very big back surgery, you can still go to your doctor and get the necessary drug that you need to not have tremendous pain in your life. But if you got into a minor car accident or if you had a minor medical procedure done, there's no longer going to be the days where you go home with 50 pills when you only need, you know, five or 10. And I think that, that law took effect in October of last year. You know, we're just about at the 8 to 10 month mark of that. And I really believe that in the next 12 months, when we get some data back, we're going to see that the number of overdoses is going to go down because the supply of these drugs in our state is going to go down.
And so the doctors have been complying? Do we know that or not?
Well, I don't have, I should say we don't really have the full data on that yet, but anecdotally, I think that that's definitely the case.
That's definitely the case. Okay. So they've sort of made a decision, at least generally speaking. And once you get the statistics, you can have a better view. I don't want to be too cynical. let's take just one quick look at the transportation lockbox issue, because I think you're on the transportation committee. Could you give us, could you give us an update on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I voted for that once again this year. It was my third time voting for that, and
yet again,
we don't have a we don't have a popular referendum like they do in Massachusetts, for example. They just legalized marijuana a couple years ago because they have ballot initiatives. We don't have that in Connecticut. The only way the voters get to decide on these things is if the legislature passes it by a two-thirds majority. We didn't do that in 2015 when I first voted on this, but the law says that if you pass it in two consecutive sessions, the same bill in two consecutive years, it does go on the ballot. So in the 2018 ballot, when folks go to vote for the state legislature and governor, they will see a question on the ballot about creating a lockbox for transportation funds. And what that really is, Marcia, is that we have something in Connecticut that's known as a special transportation fund. And some of your listeners will remember that there was a terrible accident in 1983 in Greenwich on the Mayanus River Bridge, and the bridge collapsed. And several people lost their lives. And in the aftermath of that, Governor O'Neill created what's known as the Special Transportation Fund. And that is the fund through which we fund DOT projects. The good news and bad news about that is that we have a dedicated fund. That's the good news. The bad news is that over the years, Democrats and Republicans have siphoned money out of that account to pay for other things and to plug deficits when we have them. And so by 2021, the DOT is anticipating that they're going to run out of money to fix our roads and bridges. And so my colleagues and I, there were some Democrats that voted against it. There are some Republicans that voted against it, but there was bipartisan support for this idea of creating a lap box so that any money that we should be collecting for transportation purposes can stay for just that reason. And then we won't have to worry about insolvency of this very important fund. And I'll give you one statistic, Marsha, that underscores why that's so important. And that is because the DOT right now, today, says that there are over 400 bridges in the state of Connecticut that have at least one structural deficiency, meaning that there's at least one somewhat major thing that's wrong with them and that they need to be fixed. The DOT just can't keep up with this work anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you live in our neck of the woods, like Brantford or Guilford, you probably spent a lot of your life stuck in traffic on 95 because we haven't done anything in recent history to upgrade our highways. We haven't made substantial infrastructure investments in our rail. And we're just really behind on this. And the reason for that is because we're out of money. And my hope is that with the passage of this lockbox next year by the voters, that we can get serious about really going after the much needed projects that we have to do.
And though those in the legislature who were opposed, what would be their reason?
Well, some of my colleagues on the Democratic side believe that there's a lot of important issues that require lockboxes, whether it's funding for children or funding for those with disabilities. I obviously agree with that. But transportation is a special case because there's very few programs in the state where we, you know, for the gas tax, for example, where that's supposed to go directly towards fixing our roads. And so I don't support that argument. The Republicans, you know, tend to vote against a lot of the things that we do simply because they believe they have a better way of doing it. And in this case, they feel like they had a stronger lockbox. But if I've learned anything in my first 3 years in politics, it's that the perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the good. And I would have really thought it would have been a very strong signal to the voters of Connecticut if they saw both Democrats and Republicans coming together to right the wrongs that our predecessors have made, again, from both parties, where they took money out of that fund. And, you know, God forbid something happens, you know, it's going to be something that people will look back on and say, gee, you know, I wish we really took that step. And I think it's good that we've passed it, but I think it would have been a much better signal if we had all done it together.
Right, right. Well, tell us what your views are on the rail issue that's come up on in Brantford and Guilford. Speaking of transportation.
So, the Federal Railroad Administration has something that they call the NEC Future. It's basically a set of recommendations that they are then going to deliver to municipalities and states about their recommendations of what they think we should do in the next 30 to 40 years to improve our infrastructure. And one of the things that they're going to put in that report that's going to come out in a few weeks is the suggestion that we do a bypass somewhere between Stony Creek in Brantford and Guilford, where a fast train can pass a slower train. So on the line right now, Amtrak runs an Acela train, which is the really super fast one, and then they run a regional train, which is a slower one. One of the reasons why rail service is so slow and not as fast as it is in, say, you know, Asia or Europe is because we only have one track that these trains are working off of. And so, you know, those who want to see better and faster rail service, myself 100% included, have tried to look at ways that we can do this better and more efficiently in a way to improve our infrastructure. The problem, Marcia, is, as you know, the trains of, you know, 1900, when these tracks were first built, going through neighborhoods like Stony Creek and Guilford are a lot different than an Acela train that's going 175 miles an hour.
Right.
And there's a lot of density in that neighborhood, whether it be houses, whether it be, you know, preserved, you know, environment wetlands, whether it's historical buildings, all of that has caused people to say, hey, wait a minute, this might not be the best idea for this area. And a lot of the folks that have raised some concerns about that came to me and Senator Kennedy and Lonnie and some other folks and said, hey, listen, we would really love to learn more about what their plans are. Do you think that you can ask them to come here and do that? And I wrote a letter to them asking for that. Rosa DeLauro did. Dick Blumenthal did. You know, myself, Jamie Cosgrove, Lonnie, Ted, we all did. And they wrote back to us basically saying no.
That's right.
That they were not going to come here, that this was basically just a set of recommendations, and this is not a plan. There's no money behind it. It's not happening tomorrow. And in my private conversations with them, you know, I've sort of been assured that down the road, you know, my predecessor or two predecessors from now, whoever is in office in 2040 and 2050, you know, if they think this is a good idea, they would have to go through the proper procedure of getting all the sign off, the town hall meeting, the local permitting process, the state permitting process. We're a long way from this happening. So that's the good news. The bad news is that I think it's pretty disrespectful that the FRA chose not to listen to the local representatives of these very concerned folks and simply just came up here and gave us the courtesy of some information in a public hearing. But it looks like they're not going to heed that, and I will continue to be pushing for that, and I hope that they will change their minds.
Yeah, yeah, because it's drawn a good many people to public meetings, and it's a great concern, but you're saying it's way down the road, if it ever happens.
If it ever happens, yeah. But with that said, Marcia, I certainly do understand why people are concerned, right? A lot of people live right next to these tracks, and they want to know what's going to happen to their property. And even though I don't think this is going anywhere, and I don't think it's probably going to happen, not to mention the money that would be involved in doing this,
right? And
don't certainly have at the state level, and they don't seem to have at the federal level. Right. I do understand why this is upsetting and concerning, and I think they owe us that much.
Right, because it's really on the shoreline. This is right.
Yeah,
these tracks are right. Okay, got it. Okay, well, we'll have you back another time to discuss that. One last question before we wrap it up. This year was unique in the legislature because you had an evenly divided Senate, right, and a closely kind of divided House. How did you find that in just in terms of conducting business? How was that different for you?
Well, it was definitely different. You know, as you mentioned at the top of your show, I am the co-chair of the insurance committee, and that means that in the past, usually there's one representative and one senator that chairs each committee. This year, we had one representative and then a Republican senator and a Democrat senator. So there was three chairs to every committee.
Three chairs to every committee?
It certainly
wow.
Yeah, so it certainly requires you to approach the job a little bit differently. You know, Marcia, you've covered me for a while now. We've had some extensive conversations. I really am more of a consensus kind of guy, and let's try to find a way to work together than a more, you know, partisan kind of person.
Right.
So it worked for me. With that said, the close margins that we had really forbid us from doing some things that I think we needed to do. You know, there were a few bills that come to mind that in the waning days of the legislature, we just didn't have the ability to pass them. Whether that was tolls, which is something we didn't talk about, but is obviously very important to the future of the state, in my opinion.
Right.
There were some bills dealing with women's health care that I had worked pretty hard on. There were some conversations around legalized marijuana, frankly, that people wanted to have in our caucus, and we just didn't have the ability to do it. And so I think what happened was we did pass a lot of bipartisan legislation, and that's usually the case. We just didn't have the votes to pass things that were a little more controversial. Some of those were bad bills that I probably wouldn't have supported, but some of them were good bills that I think deserved to go forward. And simply because they were controversial in years past, those of us who believed in those issues would be willing to vote for them and go and explain ourselves to our constituents. But this year, we just couldn't pass them. I would say that, you know, we all, Democrats and Republicans, have a responsibility to govern. We are all in government. And I hope in the next few weeks that we will have an opportunity to vote on a budget that could be supported by both Democrats and Republicans. And I think given our business climate, given the people who have watched the news and seen all these stories about our budget deficit, I just think it would be a really strong sign to the people of Connecticut and to, frankly, those who are looking at Connecticut to say, hey, should I move my business there? Or frankly, should I move my business out of there? Mm-hmm. If we came together and did something truly bipartisan in the best interest of Connecticut's future and not in the best interest of a political party.
Right. And I recall that you and Lonnie declined to voted against Governor Malloy's budget, correct, last year?
I did vote against the budget in my first year there in 2015.
Yep. Okay. So, I mean, you're optimistic that you will be able to vote for this one, but you're not necessarily making a commitment yet, right?
Well, I haven't seen it yet. I don't know what's in it, but I am hopeful that I can. Mm-hmm. But I'm also hopeful that the Republicans can too, right?
That's right, right.
And, you know, if there's one lesson that we have all learned this session, given the close margin, it's that we've had to work together on things. And we shouldn't just be working together on things that are politically easy. We should be working together on things that are politically hard. And I mm-hmm. think that if we can do that and find a way to do that, we can really send, like I said, a strong signal to voters that we're willing to tackle these things and not have it be about the next election. I mean, geez, the election in 2018 is a year and a half away, and right. I'm already reading all these articles about it. We just got reelected. we should be doing the job that we got reelected for 6 months ago, not thinking about our reelection a month or, you know, a year and a half away. That's what people hate about politics, and it's time that we end that cycle and just do the right thing, in my opinion.
Why? Yes, that's fascinating, and thank you so much. It looks like our time is up, Sean. It goes fast when the topics are so interesting. In fact, we're going to have you back because I really want your views on the tolls and what happened there, and we want to thank you.
Happy to come back anytime, Marcia, and it's always great to be on with you.
Okay, thank you so much, Sean, for joining us, and giving us your insight into the legislative process. And to our listeners, go to the newhavenindependent.org website to get a podcast of this broadcast and to listen to the wide variety of shows that the station is producing each day. We will have a story on this interview along with a link to the entire broadcast. Thank you, Sean.